Hi, Katie here, just hopping on quick before the episode to remind you I am co-leading a pilgrimage to Ireland this coming October 2024. Come join me and Christy Eisinger on a magical tour through the Emerald Isle, Our Lady of Knock, St. Patrick's Holy Mountain, the Rock of Cashel, the Cliffs of Moher, ancient monasteries, high tea at a castle, traditional music, sheep herding demonstrations, a literary pub crawl. This trip has it all, and we've made sure to keep a pace that is both adventurous and relaxing, with time to explore on your own, make new friends, pray, eat, and travel carefree with the expert local guides provided by Select International. Check out the show notes to download the brochure and sign up today. Sláinte!
Hi, I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
It's a mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.
Welcome to Born of Wonder. I'm Katie Marquette, and on this podcast, we explore anything and everything that inspires wonder and awe in the world. Started today's podcast episode with Spring One from Max Richter's amazing album, Vivaldi Recomposed. I just love the album, and I especially love that rendition of Spring, of course, inspired by Vivaldi's famous Four Seasons, which I love as well. I'm going to be continuing on the theme of recomposing classical pieces and sort of making them fresh and new and sort of integrating some themes of minimalism and even jazz and pop and other things like that with my recommendation at the end of the episode. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be on a similar theme with a different classical composers. But of course, I started with Spring because it is the first day of spring. Happy spring. It is also the Feast of St. Joseph. So wonderful alignment of days this year. 3 years ago, it was a day past my due date with my first daughter, so it's always sort of a evocative, emotional time of year. The forsythia is blooming in these sort of wild golden hedges in front of the house, and I remember taking my little newborn daughter out there and showing her the flowers, and I just love spring. I love spring now. I love it. I always sort of didn't love it before. It was kind of like a muddy, odd in between time, but I so appreciate it now. The weeds haven't taken over yet. Everything is blooming. I think we're going to have a frost again this week, but we've had some beautiful spring weather, so I hope you have it as well. Today on the podcast, to celebrate spring, I'm going to be telling you the story of Persephone, famously brought down into Hades, right? The daughter of Zeus and Demeter. Demeter, of course, being the goddess of the harvest. So we have all sorts of seasonal undertones here. And Persephone is associated as the vegetation goddess because she returns to Earth from the underworld every spring. Plutarch was the one to write that Persephone was identified with the spring season, and Cicero calls her the seed of the fruits of the fields. So her return from the underworld each spring, it's also a symbol of immortality, of the perpetual return, right? That like you fall into the land of death, but there is always a coming back, a resurrection of life that we see here in spring. So I'm going to read to you from Bullfinch's Mythology, the sort of quintessential text, right? It is an amazing collection to have if you sort of want a just full-on introduction to to so many of these wonderful Greek myths and legends. He does use the Roman names a lot, so I'll be reading and you'll hear Jupiter, you know, instead of Zeus, and you'll hear Pluto instead of Hades, but Persephone's name does stay the same in this, Diana instead of Artemis, and so on and so forth. But yeah, I'll sort of in the style that I did the 12 Dancing Princesses at the beginning of the season, I'll just introduce you to the story by reading selections here. I always like to give you a little sound of the sort of size book we're looking at. So the Bullfinch's Mythology, the edition I have, it's an old book. It's one of those that doesn't even have a copyright on it. I want to say it's probably like early 20th century. It belonged to my mother and possibly my grandmother as well. So if I take it here, you can hear it. I'm going to drop it on the desk. Yeah. It's a big book. Lots of pages here. And Thomas Bullfinch is the one who collected these stories. He was a teacher, and he just loved classical literature. And he got a degree in scholastic training at Harvard College, stayed in Boston as a teacher. He was an accountant in the Boston Merchants Bank, but he used his leisure time to pursue classical studies. And he would write out sort of in an accessible form the results of his reading. So in this edition here that I have of his, it includes the myths of King Arthur, which is also really fun. Like it has the Lady of Shalott, you know, which I've read the poem, The Lady of Shalott, Tennyson before, so you could read the original story there. We have the Mabinogion. We have Legends of Charlemagne. So there's all kinds of really fun things here. I think I've told you before that my husband and I, it was like a fun thing to do in the evenings, was to read these myths out loud to each other. They're quite short, most of them, and they're just fun to read out loud. We also did that with some of the Norse stories as well, and we always have great ambitions that we'll read them all, and we normally peter out on doing it, but it's always fun to pick them back up, and I think it's a fun sort of read aloud thing that to do together. So yes, I'll be reading from Bullfinch's Mythology, and having some great music here at the end, and thinking about how next week is 100 episodes of Born and Wonder. So I'm very excited about that. I'll probably be doing a reflection, sort of a summary thoughts about 100 episodes of Born and Wonder this week on Substack. So if you don't subscribe to my email newsletter, you can follow the link in the show notes to the Born of Wonder Substack page. I would love to have you following along there. I'm also going to be sharing for paid subscribers soon in the next week or two a list of, it's not specifically for postpartum, but a reader requested, you know, she's recently postpartum and wants some books that are, you know, engaging, but that you can read on very little sleep. So there are many circumstances in life, right, when maybe that might be the case when we're just really burnt out. So I will be sharing some book recommendations for those kinds of seasons of life. Although I'll be honest, both of my postpartum seasons, I've definitely been more of a TV watcher during that time, and I really loved the show Shtisel. If you've seen it, Shtisel, it's really, really fascinating about this very Orthodox Jewish community in Israel, and it's really interesting and really well done, and sort of shows a really fascinating family drama. Really, really enjoyed that show. So, or I go for my like go-to like period dramas. Like I love, you know, something so soothing, right, about like just like banal drama at the dinner table in fancy clothes, right? So I'm all for just enjoying some time, you know, like in bed with your laptop with your newborn asleep on your chest. That is a great way to spend your time as well. And of course, getting outside when you can and enjoying that beautiful spring fresh air. So yeah, so find me on Substack. You can go to bornofwonder.com. There you can also click on the page all about my upcoming trip to Ireland in October. Would love to have you there. And yeah, contact me anytime, marquettekatie@gmail.com. But let's launch into this story here, the story of Persephone. When Jupiter and his brothers had defeated the Titans and banished them, a new enemy rose up against the gods. They were giants. Some of them had 100 arms, others breathed out fire. They were finally subdued and buried alive under the mountain, where they still sometimes struggle to get loose and shake the whole island with earthquakes. Their breath comes up through the mountain and is what men call the eruption of the volcano. The fall of these monsters shook the earth so that Pluto was alarmed and feared that his kingdom would be laid open to the light of day. Under this apprehension, he mounted his chariot drawn by black horses and took a circuit of inspection to satisfy himself to the extent of the damage. When he was thus engaged, Venus, playing with her boy Cupid, espied him and said, "My son, take your darts with which you conquer all, even Jove himself," and send one into the breast of yonder dark monarch. The boy unbound his quiver and selected his sharpest and truest arrow. The straining of the bow against his knee, he attached the string and, having made ready, shot the arrow with its barbed point right into the heart of Pluto. In the Vale of Enna there is a lake embowered in the woods, which screen it from the fervid rays of the sun, while the moist ground is covered with flowers and spring reigns perpetual. Here Persephone was playing with her companions, gathering lilies and violets and filling her basket and her apron with them, when Pluto saw her, loved her, and carried her off. She screamed for help to her mother and companions, and when in her fright she dropped the corners of her apron and let the flowers fall, childlike, she felt the loss of them as an addition to her grief. The ravisher urged on his steeds, calling them each by name, and throwing loose over their heads and necks his iron-colored reins. When he reached the river and it opposed his passage, he struck the river bank with his trident, and the earth opened and gave him passage to Tartarus. Ceres sought her daughter all the world over. Bright-haired Aurora, when she came forth in the morning, and Hesperus, when he let out the stars in the evening, found her still busy in the search. But it was all unavailing. At length, weary and sad, she sat down upon a stone and continued sitting 9 days and nights in the open air, under the sunlight and moonlight, and falling showers. It was where the home of an old man was, named Celius. He was out in the field gathering acorns and blackberries and sticks for his fire. His little girl was driving home their 2 goats, and as she passed the goddess, who appeared in the guise of an old woman, she said to her, "Mother," and the name was sweet to the ears of Ceres. "Why do you sit here alone upon the rocks?" The old man also stopped, though his load was heavy, and begged her to come into his cottage, such as it was. She declined, and he urged her. "Go in peace," she replied, "and be happy in your daughter. I have lost mine." As she spoke, tears, or something like tears, for the gods never weep, fell down her cheeks upon her bosom. The compassionate old man and his child wept with her. Then he said, "Come with us, and despise not our humble roof. So may your daughter be restored to you in safety." "Lead on," said she. "I cannot resist that appeal." So she rose from the stone and went with them. As they walked, he told her that his only son, a little boy, lay very sick, feverish, and sleepless. She stooped and gathered some poppies. As they entered the cottage, they found all in great distress, for the boy seemed past hope of recovery. Metaneira, his mother, received her kindly, and the goddess stooped and kissed the lips of the sick child. Instantly the paleness left his face, and healthy vigor returned to his body. The whole family were delighted. That is, the father, mother, and little girl, for they were all. They had no servants. They spread the table and put upon it curds and cream, apples and honey in the comb. While they ate, Ceres mingled poppy juice in the milk of the boy. When night came and all was still, she arose, and taking the sleeping boy, molded his limbs with her hands and uttered over him 3 times a solemn charm, then went and laid him in the ashes. His mother, who had been watching what her guest was doing, sprang forward with a cry and snatched the child from the fire. Then Ceres assumed her own form, and a divine splendor shone all around. When they were overcome with astonishment, she said, "Mother, you have been cruel in your fondness to your son. I would have made him immortal, but you have frustrated my attempt. Nevertheless, he shall be great and useful. He shall teach men the use of the plow and the rewards which labor can win from the cultivated soil." So saying, she wrapped a cloud about her, and mounting her chariot, rode away. Ceres continued her search for her daughter, passing from land to land and across seas and rivers, till at length she returned to Sicily, whence she at first set out and stood by the banks of the river Cyane, where Pluto made himself a passage with his prize to his own dominions. The river nymph would have told the goddess all she had witnessed, but dared not for fear of Pluto. So she only ventured to take up the girdle which Persephone had dropped in her flight and waft it to the feet of the mother. Ceres, seeing this, was no longer in doubt of her loss, but she did not yet know the cause and laid blame on the innocent land. "Ungrateful soil," said she, "which I have endowed with fertility and clothed with herbage and nourishing grain, no more shall you enjoy my favors." Then the cattle died and the plow broke in the furrow. The seed failed to come up. There was too much sun. There was too much rain. The birds stole the seeds. Thistles and brambles were the only growth. Seeing this, the fountain Arusia interceded for the land. Goddess, said she, blame not the land. It opened unwillingly to yield a passage to your daughter. I can tell you of her fate, for I have seen her. This is not my native country. I come hither from Elis. I was a woodland nymph and delighted in the chase. They praised my beauty, but I cared nothing for it and rather boasted of my hunting exploits. One day I was returning from the wood, heated with exercise, when I came to a stream silently flowing, so clear you might count the pebbles on the bottom. The willows shaded it, and the grassy bank sloped down to the water's edge. I approached. I touched the water with my foot. I stepped in knee-deep, and not content with that, I laid my garments on the willows and went in. When I sported in the water, I heard an indistinct murmur coming up as if from the depths of the stream, and made haste to escape to the nearest bank. The voice said, Why do you fly, Arusia? I am Alpheus, the god of this stream. I ran. He pursued. He was not more swift than I, but he was stronger and gained upon me as my strength failed. At last, exhausted, I cried for help to Diana. Help me, goddess. The goddess heard and wrapped me suddenly in a thick cloud. The river god looked now this way and now that, and twice came close to me, but could not find me. Arusia, Arusia, he cried. Oh, how I trembled, like a lamb that hears the wolf growling outside the fold. A cold sweat came over me. My hair flowed down in streams. Where my foot stood, there was a pool. In short, in less time than it takes to tell it, I became a fountain. But in this form, Alpheus knew me and attempted to mingle his stream with mine. Diana cleft the ground, and I, endeavoring to escape him, plunged into the cavern and through the bowels of the earth came out here in Sicily. While I passed through the lower parts of the earth, I saw your Persephone. She was sad, but no longer showing alarm in her countenance. Her look was such as became a queen, the queen of Arubius, the powerful bride of the monarch of the realms of the dead. When Ceres heard this, she stood for a while like one stupefied, then turned her chariot towards heaven and hastened to present herself before the throne of Jove. She told the story of her bereavement and implored Jupiter to interfere to procure the restitution of her daughter. Jupiter consented on one condition, namely that Persephone should not during her stay in the lower world have taken any food, otherwise the fates forbade her release. Accordingly, Mercury was sent, accompanied by Spring, to demand Persephone of Pluto. The wily monarch consented, but alas, the maiden had taken a pomegranate which Pluto offered her, and had sucked the sweet pulp from the few of the seeds. This was enough to prevent her complete release. But a compromise was made, by which she was to pass half the time with her mother, and the rest with her husband, Pluto. Ceres allowed herself to be pacified with this arrangement, and restored the earth to her favor. Now she remembered Celeus and his family, and her promise to his infant son. When the boy grew up, she taught him the use of the plow and how to sow the seed. She took him in her chariot, drawn by winged dragons, through all the countries of the earth, imparting to mankind valuable grains and the knowledge of agriculture. After his return, the boy built a magnificent temple to Ceres and established the worship of the goddess, which in the splendor and solemnity of their observance surpassed all other religious celebrations among the Greeks. And that is the story of Persephone and Hades, Persephone and Pluto, the god of the underworld. Here's a little note here at the end from Bullfinch. He says, there can be little doubt of this story of Ceres and Persephone being an allegory. Persephone signifies the seed corn, which when cast into the ground lies there concealed. That is, she is carried off by the god of the underworld. It reappears, that is, Persephone is restored to her mother. Spring leads her back to the light of day. So I think that's a really beautiful story, a lot of really arresting images there. And actually, as I was reading it just now, I realized it fit in very well. If you went to Mass this past weekend for the fifth Sunday of Lent, you'll have noticed that the crosses were covered. That happens 2 weeks before Easter as we prepare to really go deep here into the Easter mysteries. in Holy Week and everything else coming up. But you will remember that the readings were all about resurrection. It was the story of Lazarus. And we have in this story, the story of Ceres, or Demeter in Greek, reviving the little boy, of restoring him to life. And of course, the whole story of Persephone is a resurrection story. And I find it so beautiful that so often the liturgical year reflects the reality of the natural world. And resurrection is the theme of spring, right? That what we thought was brown and dead and forgotten is actually risen back to life. And that is sort of a signifier of hope in the world, right? That the journey into the underworld isn't forever. And even here in this sort of waiting time, the seasons give us that promise that even during the year, even during the seasons of the year, we have sort of, we have rehearsals for the ultimate reality that is believed in the Christian faith, that there is an ultimate resurrection when the land of the dead is destroyed forever and ever. Think of Narnia. There's no more winter. There's only spring. Winter lover like myself, I can only sort of emotionally get with the metaphor so long. But who can resist? Flowers blooming in spring, right? And the first sort of warm breezes, and you see just miraculously that things come to life again. I'm always amazed, sort of the first few warm nights, that I'll start to hear crickets again, and that you'll just hear the birds, like they just come back. Everything comes back, and this sort of rhythm of return, of return, of return. And that's the story of Persephone. Is a cyclical story. It's of course a harvest metaphor and everything like that. But I think it's a deeper story too of and what C.S. Lewis would say was a good dream, that this story would be considered the myth of Persephone would be a good dream of sort of the ultimate story of resurrection fulfilled in Christ. So there we have it. I hope you enjoyed it. Maybe it'll inspire you to go check out some more Greek mythology, check out Bullfinch's mythology. But I'm gonna end today's episode here with a really, really beautiful rendition here. It's a really, really creative take on Bach's Goldberg Variations. Very famous, if you've heard Glenn Gould's version, they're lovely. I mean, I recommend listening to Goldberg Variations by Bach, but this is a rearrangement. It's called Goldberg Reflections, and much in sort of the same style that Max Richter, who's a modern minimalist type composer, sort of was inspired by Vivaldi and then did a Vivaldi recomposed, the Four Seasons recomposed. So this violinist, I'm going to not say his name correctly, so I apologize for that. He's a German violinist named Niklas Lippi. He does sort of a new version for violin and orchestra. And I'm reading here from sort of the liner sheets here about the album he did, Goldberg Reflections, explores the continued resonance of this masterpiece in our era with specially commissioned works by 11 contemporary composers. So here, I'll just read you a little bit. They, being the Goldberg Variations, are considered to be a spiritual and musical universe, like a cathedral with complex and elaborate architecture, or even the grammar of music. The variations were first published in 1741, composed and notated for two manual harpsichord, and they have, been subsequently rearranged and played in many different ways. But this violinist, he's doing a contemporary take. He's incorporating elements of jazz and pop and popular music along with the original style of the Baroque. And I think it comes up with a really creative sound. So I'm going to be playing one of his pieces here. It's the second variation. I'll put a link in the show notes for you. It has like a very bizarre music video. I don't really know what's happening in it, but he's on a farm with a bunch of alpacas and like playing his violin. But it's it's such like a whimsical, joyful piece of music that it kind of fits. So you can go check out the video as well. But I think you'll enjoy this. And I really love this. I love it. Like, some people are so like, something was made this way, it should always stay that way. And I'm so against that. Like, I'm so against stagnation. I'm into interpretation and revisiting and making things, you know, like playing with them. Like, art is about freedom and playing with sound and design and, you know, just and feeling okay to do that. You know, it's like, you know, when you go see a Shakespeare play, people who demand that it's only done in early modern dress or something, like, I think that's quite silly, because Shakespeare himself at the time was really playing with themes and going back and forth in time. And of course you'd have actors of, you know, you'd have men playing the parts of women and really playing around with that idea and things like that. Like, it was a very playful, creative enterprise. And classical music, especially if we're going to enjoy it, like, we should feel free to engage with it, like, not leave it sort of dusty in the corner, but play with it. So I, you know, Max Richter's Vivaldi Recomposed, definitely recommend, and this one here as well, the Goldberg Reflections here by Nicholas Liepe. I think that's how you say it, Liepe. So I'll play that for you. I hope it, you know, brings a lot of joy to your day, and I'm looking forward to next week. I'm going to try to think of something fun to do, or maybe it'll just be a normal episode. I don't know, but maybe I'll have some reflections or something about doing 100 episodes here of Born of Wonder. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I'm Katie Marquette, and I will talk to you next week.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.